It's time now for the infectious disease program, and Sharon has a guest on the line. We're going to go down to Florida, and Sharon Sanders with the only flu trackers in the world. Good afternoon, Sharon.
Hi, good afternoon.
And it's
all
yours.
Are you getting out of the snow up there in Atlanta?
Well, we're through with the ice, and that was a major problem. The cold weather, I mean, in the teens, and then we got just enough ice to make it a mess.
Yep. We also saw some ice and snow here in Florida, which is quite something else.
But absolutely.
Anyway, well, I'm very pleased today to announce that welcome one of the preeminent, I would say, public health bloggers, probably actually in the world, certainly in the United States. It's a group of bloggers that blog under the name Revere, and they blog for Effect Measure. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maybe it would be better in this case, since you're anonymous, roughly, slightly, that you would give us some of your background and what is all about Effect Measure.
Well, Effect Measure, the name we write under Effect Measure is Revere. The obvious thing is there is no more Paul Revere. He died in 1816. So Revere is sort of an online persona for one or more, relatively senior public health scientists. And I say senior in the usual sense, as that we're really old. So we've been around a long time practicing medicine and public health, probably for some 40 years. The Reveres know each other extremely well because of an accident of birth and history. Although only one writes at a time, we really pretty much speak as one voice. We know how each other thinks. It's not to say that we don't disagree with each other sometimes. In fact, one of the Reveres is notorious for disagreeing with himself a great deal of the time. We're sort of a unitary voice, just like you might hear a spokesman for CDC or a spokesperson for NIH or something like that, or for that matter, Stephen Colbert, who has an online personality that's not the same as this real one.
That's great. You just celebrated a 5-year blogiversary.
Yes, that's right. We've been blogging daily, 7 days a week, 365 days a year for over 5 years, which I think probably is some kind of psychiatric symptom.
Well, I think it's very much appreciated. You know, really, if you look back at the history of the Internet, you were probably one of the very first, if not the very first, group to blog, regularly and systematically on public health.
Yes, I think we were perhaps the second. There was actually a wonderful blog in environmental health and safety called Confined Space that was run by a blogger by the name of Jordan Barab. He was a real advocate for environmental health and safety, and as the worm turns, he became the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Occupational Health and Department of Health and Services, which means he was the number two man at OSHA. And while they were waiting for the OSHA director to be confirmed, he was actually the OSHA director for about almost a year. So bloggers actually can make their way in the world. He preceded us by, I would say, about 12 months, and he really was a wonderful blogger. But then we continued to do public health, and I think you're right. From that point on, we were the first public health blog, and I think we were among the first, if not the first, to do a great deal on influenza.
I think so, too. I think Dr. Racanello is also, I'm not sure, I think he may have started in 05, I'm not sure, but he's mostly virology.
Yes.
Some flu thrown in there. And then you are also one of the founders of FluWiki. Why don't you tell us about that effort?
Yeah, well, at one point a commenter on the blog said, gee, you ought to collect your flu stuff together and put it on Wikipedia. And I thought, oh, gee, the idea of having the combined wisdom of our readers available was a really good idea. Maybe we ought to do something specific to flu. At that time, there were two other bloggers that were interested in flu, would mention it every once in a while, so I was aware of them. One was a Dem from Connecticut, whose real name is Greg Dworkin. He's a pediatric pulmonologist in Connecticut. So he's a doctor who sees pediatric flu cases and, as well as asthma and lots of other things. And another was a blogger by the name of Melanie Mattson, who passed away over this last year or two. But she was also very interested in flu and possible pandemics, especially bird flu. And I emailed both of them. I said, why don't we start a wiki? And so we did, and Melanie was the publisher of it until her death, and then Dem from Connecticut took it over, and he's got a tremendous crew there, just like Flu Trackers. Flu Trackers and Flu Wiki are really two of the very best forum sites on the Internet. And our idea then was that there was just a tremendous amount of raw brain power out there. You know, people were not necessarily doctors or epidemiologists or public health officials, but boy, were they smart. And it turned out that there's a lot of things about influenza. Let me just step back for a minute and tell you why, as a public health blog, we got interested in influenza, because I'm not, by experience, a public infectious disease guy. I'm actually a cancer epidemiologist. I've been doing that for a very long time. But I was interested in public health in the 21st century and what kind of changes we should make to make this a better world. It seemed to me that the possibility of a very dangerous influenza pandemic, at that time we really, the one that looked like was on the horizon was avian influenza or bird flu, was a great lens to look at the whole question of public health through. And so we sort of fastened on influenza because an influenza pandemic sort of sticks its tentacles into almost every phase of life. So that the kind of expertise that you would need if there were a pandemic went way beyond the kind of expertise that we had as doctors or epidemiologists. So what do you do when the one person who knows how to unjam the fax machine is out sick in your small business? What do you do when the school closes and you have, both parents are working or there's a single parent and they can't, stay home with their kids for all sorts of reasons? What do you do when there's an ice storm in the Northeast and because there's been 30% absenteeism, the trucks haven't been maintained, the plows haven't been maintained as well as they might, the roads haven't been completely plowed, and there aren't enough linemen to fix the lines. We have ice storms up in the Northeast where sometimes there are 10 or 20,000 people without power for 2 or 3 days at a time. We could be facing the prospect during a pandemic in which there was lots of absenteeism amongst the linemen, where you might have communities that could be without power for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. At least it was foreseeable. We have just-in-time inventory systems. Right now, if I need blood pressure medication, they have enough blood pressure medication to last a couple of days in the pharmacy. And when they need more, they call up the warehouse and they send some more over. Well, what if the supply chain gets interrupted? So all of these things are familiar to your listeners, I'm sure. They're familiar with pandemics and the problems of pandemics, but it seemed to us that the expertise to solve those problems didn't rest with medicine and public health, that there were people out there who knew how to manage an office and people who knew how to manage maintenance crews and who had all sorts of expertise and great ideas about what to do about school closings, and that the wiki would be a way to harvest that kind of wisdom of the crowd, and I use the phrase wisdom of crowds not in any pejorative fashion, but because there's just, as Wikipedia has shown us, there's just a tremendous amount of really great thinking out there. So that was the idea behind the wiki. Then and Melanie and Greg really did all the heavy lifting, and you know, once I put the idea in their head that it was a good idea, I sort of disappeared. And you know, Greg has been running it, and along with a whole crew of dedicated people, just as you do with Food Tracker, Sharon. I know it's a gigantic job, and my hat's off to you guys.
Well, thank you for all the things that you're doing. What the blogs do, which is a little bit different than what the forums do, is that they take a particular issue, maybe one or two issues a day, or you know, every few days, and really highlight that. Where a forum format is more of a news aggregator and sort of mass analysis. And so I think it really is a nice fit to have the blogs and the discussion forums all kind of working in conjunction with each other.
That's absolutely right. And you know, I don't think the blogs could get along without the forums, and I hope the forums are, you know, find the blogs helpful. We do different things, but they're complementary things, and I'm just really impressed with the amount of expertise there is out there.
Well, it's sort of it's like an interactive library in space, and that's great because you can meet people from all over the world. I have actually friends now all over the world. And I don't know when I would have actually had a personal opportunity to do such a thing. So, and it inspires you to do more and find out more. And I know it's the same at the wiki. And you know, I've met Greg a few times and talked with him. And when we started Flu Trackers in February of 06, Flu Wiki had been up already for about 6 or 8 months. And Melanie especially was so kind to us, and you know, let us borrow from Flu Wiki, and it was very, very helpful, very much of a community spirit, and you know, we've never forgotten that, and we certainly do miss her.
Yes,
at Flu Trackers.
She was a grand lady.
Well, my first question I normally ask everyone is, what's going on with the influenza pandemic right now? What do you see happening? Where do you think we're going to be going in the next 30 days? What do you think 2010 is going to look like?
Well, there's a short answer to all three of those questions, which is the truthful answer, and then there's the longer answer. Right? The short answer is, I don't know, and I feel quite confident that nobody else knows what's going to happen. You know, flu is famously unpredictable. Maybe one of the least predictable infectious diseases we know of. So, and it's a very dangerous disease. People, you know, have a tendency to shrug it off sometimes because they have an experience with it that's not so bad. But as I've said on the blog, it's a lot like auto accidents. In fact, auto accidents and influenza kill about the same number of people every year on average. And an auto accident usually is very minor. In fact, sometimes you don't even know you have one. Somebody scratches your car in the parking lot, and you don't notice it. Or there's a little dent or a fender bender. Or a little bit worse, you get bumped. You could get a whiplash. Worse ones, you get broken bones. Those are really the tip of the iceberg. They're, most auto accidents aren't really serious ones like that, but some of them kill you. And when you have a couple of tons worth of moving steel, you don't take it for granted. You get a couple of tons of moving steel that hits you at 5 miles an hour can cost you an awful lot of money. We all know that. If we have automobiles. And influenza, in a way, is like that. Even a mild case of influenza, and I don't even like using the word mild with respect to influenza, can cost you a lot of money. All right, so if you're out of work for 3 or 4 days, or your kids are out of school for 3 or 4 days, that's a lot of money. It's probably as much as a fender bender if you add it all up. So this is, and the other thing about an automobile accident is that doesn't matter how healthy you are, and in a way it doesn't even matter how good a driver you are, you can have a catastrophic accident. It's not exactly luck, because people have risk factors for having bad auto accidents. They drive too fast, they're inattentive, they drink and drive, and so on, and the same thing is true of influenza. If you have risk factors, you can have a worse outcome. But it's also true that lightning can strike when you're driving a car, and the same thing is true of influenza. It's really a dangerous disease in the same way that an automobile accident is dangerous. And I have tremendous respect for influenza as a disease, and I wish that we understood it more. One of the things that surprised me most as a scientist when I first got into the food business was how many things there were that people take for granted that we know about flu that we don't really know.
Well, Dr. Osterholm has said several times he knows less now than he knew 5 years ago, so...
Yeah, that's right. In fact, you know, first time I heard him say it, he said 20 years ago. And, if Mike were here now, he'd probably say 6 months ago. We're going to learn a tremendous amount from this pandemic because of all the attention that's been focused on it and the number of new tools that we have been able to bring to bear to look on it. The problem is what we're going to learn from it is probably not going to help us very much in this pandemic. It's going to take years to sort of sift through the massive experience and data and new science that's being developed now. And so, this pandemic will be over with and gone. Now, there are others that could come along, and the world is a different world now than it was 100 years ago. It's much more tightly connected. Things happen much more quickly, and we see them much more quickly and tell each other about them much more quickly. So not only things happen more quickly, but our reactions to them happen much more quickly.
Someone had said, or the conversations have been brought up, that if we didn't have the surveillance that we do have, being in more modern times, this last bout of swine flu, or H1N1, might have gone fairly unnoticed in the blip of, a community happenings. Therefore, what phase, we talk about the three phases of 1918, maybe, this is a pre phase to that, or this is pre-1, was this 1 and 2? You know, I guess, like you're saying, we don't really know, we're rewriting the books now. Yes,
we're rewriting the book.
So, one thing that's very concerning to me, and I think Mike Costin, of Avian Flu Diary, had talked about this on the radio one time, that basically this has been like two separate flus. There's this, quote-unquote, like you said, mild, and you hate to say mild, but a lot of people have tolerated this flu fairly well, lots of people. But then there's this virulent lung attack version that if you're the wrong person with the wrong pre-existing conditions or other things we actually maybe don't know about, it can be very fatal and you can really go down in a matter of just a few days.
That's true. And I guess one thing I would say is that in some respects that's characteristic of all flu, even seasonal flu. It does kill a significant number of people. But one of the things that's really different about the pandemic strains are that they kill a different group of people. So, in fact, my age group is not being hit especially hard by this particular virus, and it isn't exactly clear why. We seem to have some kind of resistance to it, and nobody is really clear where that comes from. But the younger age groups are being hit very much harder than usual by seasonal flu. Than they are with seasonal flu by this flu, and that change in the pattern of disease in the population, which is what we call its epidemiology, is really what's most significant about this. That it can be young, healthy people who are going down rather than people who are in their 60s or 70s, which is the way seasonal flu usually kills people. But seasonal flu can do exactly the same things as you're talking about. There's sort of a distribution of effects, whether it's sort of a bell-shaped curve that's continuous or it's got two peaks in it, we don't really exactly know. So when I was talking about the things that people assume we know about influenza that we don't really know, that's on the list, which is what makes a virus virulent. That's one question. So we can't look at the genetics of the virus and tell whether it's a virulent virus yet. We haven't learned how to read the biology off the gene sequence. Why are some people hit hard and not other people? Is it that the virus is different, or are the people different? Or is it something to do with the environment? So virulence, that is how severe the disease is really sort of a, has three components to it. One is the environment that it's in. The other is the host that the virus is in, and the third is the virus itself. And those three things differ from person to person and community to community. One of the really extraordinary things that we don't understand about flu is how patchy and variable it is. So even in 1918, it was true that one community could be almost untouched, and a community 10 or 15 miles away could be devastated by the flu. That's also true with seasonal flu, which is that one community can be very hard hit, and one just down the road from it won't be. Some states get hit early in the season, some states get hit late in the season, and it's not just because the flu hasn't managed to get there yet. There are things about the environment that, and the population that the flu virus finds itself in that makes it appear different. And that's another thing that we don't understand, is exactly what all those factors are. We know some of them. So if you have a pre-existing disease like asthma or heart disease, or you're pregnant, those are risk factors for a bad outcome. But there are obviously other things that are involved, and we don't understand them. Another thing we don't understand that people assume we do is, how is flu spread from person to person? That comes as a big surprise to people, that we don't completely understand the mechanism by which flu is passed from one person to another. So there are three possibilities here. One of them is coughing and sneezing produces very big droplets, and those big droplets are, you know, loaded with viral particles, and another person breathes them in. A second possibility is that the thing about those big droplets is they fall to the ground very quickly, and they can be stopped by, you know, relatively simple means like a surgical mask. A second possibility, though, is that the droplets aren't real big. They're real tiny. Have you discussed this on the show before?
Yes, we have. I mean, but you know, assume that this is for the first time, because we have always new students and new people coming in, and of course, lots of people were interested in hearing you for the first time. So, you know, act like we don't know.
Okay. So, supposing they're real tiny, what's the difference whether the droplet that's produced by your cough or your sneeze or your talking or your singing or whatever it is big, or it's whether it's small? Well, if it's big, you could stop it with a surgical mask, and it falls to the floor relatively quickly. But if it's real tiny, it can remain suspended in the air, not just for minutes and not just for hours, but perhaps for days at a time. Practically speaking, what that means is that if you're in a hospital emergency room or in a streetcar or something like that, if it's a large droplet, it's the people right around you who are coughing and sneezing that you have to worry about. But if it's tiny droplets that remain suspended for hours or days at a time, it's the person who coughed or sneezed, you know, not only across the room, but maybe yesterday that you have to worry about. And instead of a surgical mask, you'd have to have a respirator, one of these N95 masks that was well fitted to your face. And if you have a beard or a mustache, you couldn't even wear one of those and have it protect you. So there's a very big practical difference here. And the truth is that between those two possibilities, we don't know which one is the most important, although it's a very big and important question. And then there's the third possibility of inanimate objects. For example, the doorknob, the hand armrest in the airplane, the pencil, the keyboard, the public keyboard that you sat down in. We know that there is replicable flu virus recoverable from inanimate objects, non-porous inanimate objects like desks and doorknobs and stuff like that for not only hours, but perhaps days and maybe even weeks at a time. What we don't know is whether that makes any difference, whether anybody can actually catch flu that way. There's almost nothing in the literature of an outbreak of influenza that's been traced to inanimate objects. The one exception is a nursing home outbreak that occurred a couple of decades ago, and in which the inanimate object was actually a thermometer. Right. So that's kind of a special case. That hasn't stopped us from using hand sanitizers and closing schools and cleaning them top to bottom with boiling Lysol or something like that. But the truth is that we don't really know whether that has any effect on flu. Hand washing is effective for a number of respiratory and intestinal diseases. We know that from studies, but we just don't know. We don't have any evidence of it for flu. Another thing we don't know about flu that people are familiar with the fact that there's something called flu season. Usually, when there's not a pandemic, runs somewhere between November to March or April. We don't know why flu is seasonal. There have been lots of suggestions. There was recently Peter Pallese at Mount Sinai, who was Vincent Recagnolo's
mentor,
actually did some experiments with guinea pigs in which he said he showed that relative humidity was the thing that determined whether flu virus would remain viable in the air for long periods of time, or periods long enough so that people could infect each other. Well, I actually have a lot of respect for Peter. He's one of the great flu scientists in the world. But from the epidemiological perspective, there's some counter evidence. So there was a paper from flu season, looking at seasonality in Nicaragua, which is a tropical country. It's interesting that there's very little surveillance for influenza in tropical areas. So we know very little about what the pattern, the seasonal pattern of influenza is in the tropics. But this paper, which was published last year or the year before, which I wrote about in the blog, looked at seasonality in Nicaragua. And there were years in which there were two peaks. Not just one peak, but two peaks. And one of the peaks was in July and August. July and August in Nicaragua is the rainy season, and it's the hottest season. So you have temperatures, very warm temperatures, and 100% humidity all the time. And yet that was one of the peaks of seasonal influenza in Nicaragua. That doesn't quite square with the idea that humidity is the thing that's driving seasonality. The most common suggestion of what drives seasonality is social factors like return to school and crowding and indoors, especially when the weather is colder. That hasn't been shown to be the case either, although it's pretty hard to study it. So, you know, that's still a possibility. Then there's the vitamin D hypothesis, which is that vitamin D protects you and that when there's less sunlight, you have less vitamin D, and on. There's a whole list of suggestions as to what might be causing flu to be seasonal, but as of now, we don't know which, if any, or which combination of them is what's really doing it.
Sharon, we need to take a break. You're listening to America's Web Radio. We'll be back with Sharon Sanders and her guest on the Infectious Disease Hour here on America's Web Radio right after this.
Hi there, it's Edie Hill, and I hope you'll join me on Tuesday and Thursday mornings, 8 a.m. Eastern, for Good Morning with Edie Hill on americaswebradio.com. It's discussion that is frank and entertaining.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood, and I've practiced family medicine in the Houston area for over 26 years. A few months ago, I was introduced to a holographic pain-relieving chip by a young man I'd coached in Little League Baseball 16 years ago. Skeptically, I tried the chip on my right knee, and amazingly, the pain I had experienced for the past 2 years was significantly improved in hours and gone within weeks. And although the chip does not heal or cure, the pain relief was remarkable, and I will continue to wear the chip. To find out more about this product, go to americaswebradio.com and click on the pain relief button. It works for me, and it just might help your pain problem as well. I'm Dr. Bo Kirkwood. Thank you for your time.
Hi, this is Ann Lauren, host of the Bella Petite Hour, featuring guest celebrities, fashion, beauty experts, and industry professionals. We invite you to join in on the discussion. We have fresh news, the latest trends, business professionals, and what's happening on the entertainment scene. And you may even win some prizes. Tune in every Tuesday at 1 p.m. at Eastern Standard Time on America's Web Radio for the latest news on fashion, entertainment, and lifestyle.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Nobody ever calls me.
Now back to the Infectious Disease Hour with Sharon Sanders from Florida and her guest.
Hi, well, we're back. Usually what I do in the middle is I take a minute to do sort of like a Food Trackers commercial. And what that really is just to thank everyone who helps us on the site. And, of course, many of these members also contribute to FluWiki and are members of FluWiki. And, you know, we all swap data all the time. So it's really thanking a lot of people in Flublogia. And I'm sure that some of the names will be familiar to you. ARR309, Alaska Denise, Apple Blossom, Alert, Amish Country, Anne, John Barry, Blue, Bonesit, Michael Costin, Selvin 11, Chuck Kartsky, Common Ground, Dark Horse, David Fetson, Greg Dworkin, Dutchy, Emily, Disamama, Evelyn Estacion, Farmer, Frenchy Girl, German Doctor, GSGS, Ganderspill, Hawkeye, Hogweed, Hornblower, Ironor Hopper, Jeremy, Jim O, Jay Jackson, KBD, Kent Nickel, Kiwi Bird, Laidback Al, Legadillo, Lili, El Monte, Makato, Missouri Watcher, Michelle Marier, Mathematician, Melly, Mama Bird, El Monte, Mingus, Mixon, Mod Tech, Muscad, Nancy, Nico, Pathfinder, J.C. Rao, Ruth B. Me, Prep Deb, Roror, Ready Mom, Pathfinder, Shiloh, Steve Osteen, Susan Chu, Snickle Fritz, Sharp, Science Teacher, Shannon, Teresa 42, Scott McPherson, Shiloh, Gretton Woodson, Sally Furness, Thornton, Zakermis, Tual, Tonka, Trayfish, and there's more, you know, but it's hard to get everybody in all the time. I've been told a few times it's not very professional to list all these people with their names like that. But my response really is that I'm not really a professional radio person, so I don't care. I think it's really important to thank these people. Some of them have been looking for years and finding interesting information and posting on all the sites and creating a dialogue and raising awareness. And I just think it's really important to thank them. Because people do download these podcasts sometimes, and we have thousands of downloads, and I think it's important that their work is acknowledged, since, of course, you know, we can't pay anyone to do all this for us.
That was a real who's who of the food blog world, too.
Yeah, well, that's really, really great. What would be your biggest concern, then, going forward here this year? You know, this week, I guess the federal government has announced this is vaccination week. So I guess, first of all, I think you are vaccinated for H1N1. And why did you do that? And, you know, did you think you had the swine flu? And did you vaccinate anyway? Or, you know, what's your situation there?
Well, I'm not aware that I had it, although my daughter had it. So it wouldn't be too surprising if I had an asymptomatic or subclinical case of it that I wasn't aware of. But I was vaccinated both for seasonal flu and for swine flu because it seemed to me that that was the most rational thing to do from what we know about the science of this, that vaccines raise antibodies against these viruses, and the more antibodies you have, the better off you are. I know it won't protect me 100%, and there's always been some question about what the immune system of us older folks is able to do, but it's the best thing that I can do at the moment, not only for myself, but for my community, because if I don't get sick, then I don't pass it on to other people either.
Right. But, you know, we have, my family has it, had, you know, got the shot too, and again, our reasoning is sort of the same, which is even if it only affords, you know, even a few months from now, partial protection, that's still better than not having any protection. And my children are 19 and 26, sort of in that target age of young adults that haven't, you know, tolerated this flu as well as the seasonal flu.
That's exactly right. And in fact, you know, that age group is really in the crosshairs of this virus. And you just don't know what can happen or what might happen, so why take a chance? Is there a risk from a vaccine? The truth of the matter is there's a risk from any kind of medicine that you take, whether it's over-the-counter medicine or a vaccine. But the risk from this vaccine is so many orders of magnitude less than the risk of the virus that it's sort of a no-brainer calculation to make.
Well, it appears that a lot of the Western countries have not been successful in their citizens getting the shots, and some are now selling, of course this is good news for the third world, selling their vaccinations abroad. The U.S., I think, has put a slowdown on its orders, but hasn't started to sell any excess yet. You know, did the U.S. order too much? I mean, there's actually a global shortage in the real sense.
Yes, there is. And the rich countries like the United States have essentially put a lock on a lot of the productive capacity for making flu virus antigen. So, you know, my view is that if people don't use it here, let's say by some date certain, I originally said January 15th, but it was delayed, but let's say February 15th, if they don't use it, then except for a small reserve supply, we should give our flu away, our flu vaccine away. If people have had ample opportunity to get it and choose not to, then there is lots of people who need it and who want it around the world who haven't been able to get it because, as a rich country, we precluded them from getting it. That could, you know, that's sort of a hard attitude to take because there are lots of reasons why people might not get vaccine, and some of them might not be their fault, and it might result in the death of some American children and or young adults, and that would be a real tragedy, and that's because we gave it away. That would be a tragedy, but I don't see that American children are necessarily of any more value than any other children in the world, and that vaccine will save some lives, and it doesn't matter on the globe where those lives are.
It seems that if people have really made up their mind not to get the vaccine, there isn't really any way to sort of convince them to do it, and therefore, why let the vaccine just sort of expire?
Yeah, that's right. Now, you know, why people decide to get the vaccine and why they don't is very complicated, and a lot of it, you know, has to do with, you know, practical matters of not having the time or not really feeling that it's important to their lives. If a third wave comes along and it's bad, then people will regret not having had the vaccine. It'll be too late at that point, but they will regret it. And that's one of the calculations that you have to make. I don't know whether there's going to be a third wave. If this so far this pandemic has been sort of a copy of the 1957 pandemic, which did have a third wave in January, February, and March. But this isn't 1957. In 1957, they didn't have a vaccine for the pandemic strain, which was an H2N2. And now we have, and we've vaccinated quite a lot of people, especially in the younger age groups. So I don't know what kind of difference that's going to make. And there are other things about 2010 that are not the same as 1957 either. Some of them may make it more likely to have a third wave and some of them less likely. We just don't understand the dynamics of this well enough to be able to predict that.
Well, we're going to our typical flu season. So if we were going to have a flu season, it would be probably H1N1, but we don't know how bad that will be. We don't know if it's going to be the same or worse or what.
Yes, I think it's likely that if we were to have a third wave, it would be an H1N1. But we could have also a regular seasonal flu season. That's also a possibility. Regular seasonal, you know, a lot of things, I keep coming back to all the things that we don't understand, but this is certainly one of them. So in 1918, the pandemic virus was also an H1N1 virus. Where it came from is in dispute, but let's just put that aside for a second one. So the seasonal influenza virus between 1918 and 1957 was all the same subtype, H1N1. So just to, you know, recap a little what these letters H and the numbers mean, the flu virus wears clothes. You think of it as a pants and a shirt. our immune system recognizes different combinations of pants and shirts. So every once in a while, the flu virus changes its shirt and changes its pants, and in between those big style changes, it also makes little changes, which makes it a little harder for our immune systems to recognize things. So there's 16 different kinds of shirts, and that's a protein called hemagglutinin, or the H, and there are 9 different kinds of pants. So there's 144 different combinations, but only a few of those combinations are in viruses that infect human beings. And it's really only the H1, H2, and H3 that regularly have infected human beings, and the N1 and the N2. Now, there have been infections with some of the other subtypes, and the natural home for a flu virus is in birds. So H5N1 can infect human beings, and when it does, it's a devastating disease. It kills over half of the people who get infected with it. But it's not very transmissible. There are a couple of other pants and shirts combinations, like H7N7 and H7N2 and H9N2, that do infect human beings also, but it's not very common. At least we don't think it's very common. Usually only one of these pants and shirts combinations circulated at any one time. So between 1918 and 1957, the only pants and shirt combination that our immune systems ever saw was the H1N1 combination. Then there was a sudden change, and that's what causes a pandemic. So instead of H1N1, the flu virus decided to put on an H2N2 pant and shirt. And our immune systems had never seen it before, and that's why almost everybody on the globe was susceptible at once. There were no pre-existing immunities to it, and it caused a pandemic. When it did that, the H2N2 virus completely replaced H1N1. H1N1 disappeared, so there wasn't any H1N1 after 1957. Then in 1968, the flu virus changed its pants-shirt combination once again, and became an H3N2. And it's probably been described on this program before how that kind of change occurs, but let's just, you know, recognize that it does. When H3N2 came along, it completely replaced H2N2, so there was only one pants and shirt combination circulating in the population in between 1968 and 1977. And then in 1977, something very strange happened that was completely different from the entire experience from 1918 when we started looking at this, even before we knew what viruses were, all the way up through 1977. That entire period, there was only one subtype of flu circulating in the population at one time. First it was H1N1, then it was H2N2, then it was H3N2. But in 1977, while H3N2 was circulating, H1N1 came back. Where did it come from? We don't really know, but actually in Vincent Recaniello's laboratory, his lab chief, Peter Pallese, found that the H1N1 that came back in 1977 was virtually identical to one that was found in a freezer in Russia in 1950. So the suspicion is that this was a lab accident, maybe in a vaccine factory in Russia or China. But when it came back in 1977, H3N2 didn't go away. So for the very first time that we knew about, there were two subtypes, two pants and shirts combinations of influenza circulating at one time. And that's what the experience of seasonal influenza has been since 1977. There's been two seasonal influenza viruses, and they circulated at once. Some years it's more of an H3N2 year, and they tend to be worse years than H1N1 years, but in almost every year both types of those viruses are present. And there's another type of influenza virus, influenza B, that's also circulating. So the seasonal vaccine that people get is for these seasonal viruses, H1N1 seasonal, H3N2 seasonal, and influenza B. So there's three components to it. When this virus came along, it turned out it was also an H1N1, but it was so completely different. It was entirely flu, entirely swine components, genetic components to it, although some of those internal components had in the more distant past been in birds or humans. They had most recently only been in pigs. So when it came back, it was so different than the current seasonal H1N1 that most people had no immunity to it. So then, for a while in April, there were four viruses circulating. Three seasonal viruses, an influenza B, the two seasonal H1N1 and H3N2, and then this new swine flu virus. Now it seems that the swine flu virus has pretty much entirely replaced the seasonal virus. But there is still seasonal virus around. There's, a month or two ago, I think about a third of the cases in China were still seasonal viruses, H3N2 and H1N1 seasonal. So it's not inconceivable to me that they could come back during regular flu season and afflict older people like me. Anybody can get influenza B, because it's so different than the influenza A, that the vaccine doesn't seem to affect it. It's almost certain that the swine flu would still be around. Will we have four viruses circulating at once during flu season, or will H1N1 swine flu completely crowd out the other influenza A viruses? That's a big question. I don't know the answer, but it's one of the two reasons that I bothered to get a seasonal flu vaccine this year. Even though the seasonal flu influenza A viruses aren't around, influenza B will probably be around, and I have no complete confidence that there won't be another regular seasonal influenza virus. I don't think we understand at the moment how that crowding out that's occurred in the past, and which seems to be occurring now but didn't occur in 1977, how that works.
Hmm. We have some questions here from a couple of people, you know, that are on the site.
Uh-huh.
We were re-interviewed today.
Okay.
And there's one from GSGS.
Mm-hmm.
He asks the same question a lot. He would like to know if you have an opinion on what is the subjective probability estimate that there will be a human influenza pandemic with the H5 subtype in the next 5 years?
Well, GSGS, you know, has asked me that question on the blog, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I usually, you know, say the same thing. I truthfully don't know and don't have a basis for saying.
Mm-hmm.
Subjectively, I'm worried about it, but I have a tremendous difficulty putting a number on it, because I just don't have any confidence in any number that I would give. I guess I feel confident enough to say that it's not zero and it's not 100%, and I suspect it's not, you know, I was going to say it's not even 50%, but the truth is I'm not really confident of that either.
Right, right. That's a tough one. And Vibrant62 would like, her question is, many media outlets are reporting the H1N1 pandemic in the Northern Hemisphere over. What is your opinion on such statements, and what risk do you perceive of a more virulent wave emerging at some point within the next 10 months or so? I think we've answered that.
Yeah, but again, I don't know. It certainly could happen, or it could just be another wave, not necessarily more virulent, but just another wave. We've had two waves already.
Mm-hmm. Laidback Al has asked, how do we know the pandemic is over? I mean, don't we just go to another wave of some other, you know, flu virus? I mean,
well, that's really two questions. The first question, how do we know this pandemic is over? We don't. And I'm not confident that it is, because if we have a third wave, then it's not over. The other question is, couldn't there just be another pandemic? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And there's no reason why we still couldn't have an H5N1 pandemic, or an H7N7, or an H7N2. We don't really have a good way to predict when these things will happen.
We have H5N1 in humans ongoing now.
We do. It's been sort of simmering and percolating back there bubbling away in the back burner. What it hasn't done is boil over.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is that it's still not very transmissible from person to person. There are some reasonably well-documented cases of instances where that's happened. But given that the incredibly large amount of exposure that occurs, because it's in, you know, millions,
everywhere,
tens of millions, if not billions of poultry,
mm-hmm,
there aren't very many human cases. For a long time, you know, people thought, and I was one of them initially in the first year or two, that there probably were a lot of human cases that we just weren't detecting because, you know, they were subclinical or asymptomatic, because flu is that way. Even this flu, about half of the cases are asymptomatic. But every time we've looked really hard with the best tools that we have to look for, we don't find the asymptomatic cases, which is kind of worrying. It would be nicer, actually, if we did find them, because it would mean that this thing wasn't as virulent as it is. But this is one of these things that it's pretty hard to catch. But, boy, once you catch it, you know, it's a flip of the coin.
Yeah, it's got a high case fatality rate, that's for sure. I think it's still at 60%.
I don't actually give a lot of credence to those exact numbers because it's sort of hard to know what the denominator is, but it's really, really high. And compared to the 1918 flu, it's 10 or 20 times higher. So that's pretty
even
bad.
20% is a high number.
Yes, 20% would be a catastrophe.
Absolutely. So 60 is just not even, you can't even get your mind around that one.
No.
20 would be outrageous.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what I tell my students is if H5N1 becomes transmissible at the same case fatality rate that we have now, then the thing to do is to sit down, put your head between your legs, and kiss your ass goodbye.
Right. That would be almost as good as anything else, I guess.
Yeah.
Better run,
right.
I don't know.
Right.
Michelle Marier, who's also known as Snowy Owl, would like to ask, in the public health infrastructure now, based on what we know that's, you know, generally going on with all the infectious diseases we have, and, of course, we're losing some of our antibiotics, et cetera, where would be the best place to spend money, do you think?
Well, the Revere's position on the blog has been relatively consistent about this, which is the way you prepare for a pandemic is that you invest heavily in public health and social services infrastructure. And so you make the public health system stronger and you make the social services system stronger, because the problem with influenza, as I, you know, said at the beginning of the program, goes so far beyond the medical purposes. If you invest heavily in a vaccine, I have no problems with investing in vaccines or antivirals. It's good for that one virus and maybe even only that one strain if it's a vaccine. But if you invest in public health infrastructure, it's an all-hazards investment. It'll make, and we know from the 1918